I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Charlie Newton. He's author of the new thriller, Traitor's Gate. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good to be back, MC. Good to be back. How are you?
Great. And I really, really enjoyed this epic novel. It takes place in the 1930s on the eve of World War II, and as you call it, the bloodiest and most profitable war in human history. And it tells the story of the development of, among other things, aviation fuel, which was key to the air bombardments of World War II. How did you come across this whole story?
Well, the character Eddie Owen is based upon allowed me to interview him before he died. And he asked me, because I knew his history, if it ever dawned on me to put the dates together of why he was attempting to convert refineries to 100-octane gasoline when no engines existed that could burn them, and that there were no airplanes that had the hypothetical engine in them that had ever been tested. So it seemed kind of out of order, given that the world was awash in the difficulties it was. And he kind of led me through this amazing perspective of looking at how the world's partners came together pre-World War II, and one of the base functions was all of them believed that the First World War had been fought and won in the trenches, and the Second World War, which was now inevitable in their minds, this is the early 1930s, would be fought in the sky. Whoever could fly farther and faster would win, and in order to do that, you had to crack carbon at create 100-octane gasoline that would allow the efficiency of these engines. And he was one of the eight people on planet Earth that theoretically could do it.
And so you actually knew this guy, and you based the character of Eddie Owen on him. He's, the character, is a petroleum engineer from Oklahoma, and his family is trying to survive during the Dust Bowl, and he's dealing with all the problems of the Dust Bowl, crop loss and bankers and failing health from the relentless dust. And Eddie Owen, who didn't have a lot of choices, decided to work with bootleggers. Even though Prohibition was over, Oklahoma remained a dry state. And I think it's one of the more poignant themes of the book that when times are tough, it's nearly impossible to make good choices. No matter how pure your motives, in Eddie's case, saving his family from ruin, you can get in trouble really fast.
Yeah, I think morality and the moral compass, at least in my case, it came down to the Ten Commandments, didn't seem to add up terribly well. There wasn't an asterisk after the fifth one, thou shalt not kill, was just don't do that. Yet people found all kinds of reasons to say, well, under these modifications, God didn't really mean that. So I, like Eddie, adopted two, do unto others and keep your word. And the fact that the local governments were saying you shouldn't drink was sort of irrelevant, not sort of, was completely irrelevant to him. And he hooks up with Benny Binion, who became famous for the World Series of Poker, but at that time was a major gangster in Texas, a bootlegger. And he's selling liquor to the Blue Bloods in Oklahoma City and the Petroleum Club, who are deeply interested in the moral compass of America, you know, when they're confronted with that. But they're also interested in drinking, which is, you know, kind of typical of American mythology. And Eddie, this character, the only way, after he's blown up in the oil field, working at the only job he can find, even though he graduates magna cum laude at the University of Oklahoma, all he can find is a job in the oil field, and he's lucky to get that. When he gets blown up on an oil rig, the only job he can do sitting down is driving bootleg whiskey. He didn't have to do it. He could have taken some other position, whatever that might be, but the morality of it wasn't a point to him. It was to his family. They didn't know he was doing it, but it's, I think that morality plays out in all of our lives all the time. And so he's very much us. As he's confronted with, he's not killing women and children or robbing banks. He's doing something that he feels morally comfortable with that also solves a problem that he believes he's capable of solving.
I find it interesting, and this is not the first novel in which you've done that, I find it interesting that you use people's real names, Benny Binion being only one example. So, I mean, it's a book of fiction, but it's filled with actual characters from real life. How do you juggle that fact and fiction in your work? And do you therefore feel like you have to paint them absolutely true to life as closely as possible?
Mainly what I do is I try to frame everything, in every character that's real or composite, in the absolute closest, realist position based on how I know them or how I knew about them. Then the characters that are going to do things that are villainous or abhorrent in some way and who are still alive, I change their names so I won't get sued for it and the publishers will still publish the book. In a case of a historical novel, you can pretty much everybody is dead, so you could say whatever you want. The character Eddie Owen, one of the two protagonists, I changed his name for my own reasons that had nothing to do with his behavior, just it was a personal reason that I didn't want to name who it was. The other people in it are who they are, but I'd say 95% of them. I mean, it would be like writing nonfiction, because if you don't, I mean, you lose all that, the poignancy of the, and that makes this the first historical novel I'd ever written. It makes it really difficult if you live within the lines. Like I have a friend, Jonathan Eig, who writes lots of nonfiction biographies, and he said, you know, you can immediately tell a bad one when a guy's inside the character's head talking and thinking and making up all these mechanizations that propel the story well, but you know that never happened. And so in my case, in the case of this, is I'm looking at who these people are. And so I'm not saying anything about Hermann Göring that he didn't say, or that when somebody else is describing him that he hasn't been described as. I'm really doing my best not to try to manufacture their personality. The people whose personalities I do manufacture, characters that are cut from multiple cloths, I take all the liberty I want to with them.
Well, the other character, the other central character of the book is a woman named Sabah Hosune, who's a young Palestinian woman from Jerusalem whose entire family is killed by British colonial soldiers in 1929. She's a teenager. She's captured. She's brutally assaulted. Eventually, she's sold to a Bedouin warrior fighting for Arab independence from its colonizers. And she becomes a warrior herself and a legendary figure in her own time. Now, who is this? How did you create this character?
She's based on three women that the Eddie Owen character knew, then reframed in an Arabic light, sort of along the line of Joan of Arc. That she becomes, this for me, this wonderful central figure to have the argument about feminism in the Middle East, Robin Hood, the idea of Che Guevara, whoever romanticized into something that they almost never are, people that are driven towards this one goal, much like, let's say, an Olympic athlete becomes less dimensional than a regular person because they're so completely focused on whatever their sport is. And so the people who I have known who have fought in revolutions or have had very strong commitments to various causes are often deeply flawed people who may or may not win the day, and if they do, are then romanticized into this multifaceted person that they never were. And I really felt like to tell the story of a group of people fighting for an independence of a state with then the most dominant, ruthless power on earth. And for your audience, the vast majority of people taught to think of England as the little island that could, based on their experiences in World War II. And in fact, the English were the Nazis before the Nazis. If you ask almost anyone across Asia, the English and to a lesser degree the French were absolute monsters. And they are the colonial power in Palestine. And they are the ones that anoint the monarchs and indirectly rule, and most people have some idea of how that period went. And so she's confronting this machine that's unbeatable, that's just, they're incapable of conceiving that Arabs could do something like run their own lives. And I'm in no way romanticizing the Arabs either, or the various tribes or factions. It was just a really classic way, and that she is based on these three women, the Eddie Owen character knew, all who were various parts of this feminist, revolutionary, assaulted person, ex-victim. Became a wonderful crucible for me to use as a vehicle to walk through their side of the story.
Yeah, very much so. And I really appreciate what you just said, which is that you don't romanticize anybody. And as I was reading it, it really brought home to me the extent to which we, when we look back at history, we have very crudely painted ideas about who were the good guys and the bad guys. And as you say, you know, England was absolutely brutal, but, you know, a few more decades go by and we completely forget about it. And in this book, it's almost like there's really not a lot of good guys at all. Everyone seems to be driven by pretty ruthless goals, either ideology like the Nazis and the Zionists, or greed like the capitalists. And there's also a lot of strange bedfellows, people with common enemies who, again, put their morality, whatever morality they might have had, in the back seat. And I was wondering if you could talk to us about some of the interests of these various parties, from American corporations to these various nations on down.
Well, I think, you know, I would start the explanation with it's everything that's true in this book's true today. You could change the dates and a couple of the names, and it's the same argument, and it was the same argument in Roman times.
Exactly.
And so what I found was that there's probably no novel that I could conceive that could outdo history. And then the idea of the oh my God moments when you find out various things that you read in the novel, that I truly thought the media, when this book came out 2 weeks ago, would just be stunned by some of that. But to date, I haven't had one person ask me one question about those things. And so when I was listening to the Eddie Owen character tell me the story, the parts of it that he told me, we got into the strange bedfellows part of do you wonder why, and what is the real history of whether England, the Soviet Union, Germany, and the United States were always en route to becoming that partnership, or was it probably going to go a different way? And were there long periods of time where the capitalists in America were looking at this not as a state argument, but as an economic system argument? Communism, socialism, or let's just say communism, fascism, and capitalism. And that the American industrialists were deeply embedded in capitalism, of course, and the second best thing, or maybe the best thing for them, would be fascism or a fascist partner, but the worst thing for them would be communism. And you can state communism during that period, and this is the Great Depression and Dust Bowl, as labor unions. And you can look at Irenée DuPont, who owned General Motors at the time, and a number of other of these corporate tycoons who have since been somewhat whitewashed in their behavior, and they formed things like the Black Legion and just tremendously powerful organizations to destroy the unions. I'm not picking, saying I love unions or don't, but the concept was unions were legal and that they had to be demonized and they had to be attached to a demon. That's the Soviet Union and the Russian Revolution and what had happened there. And so these guys were very much in tune with, we don't want to be partners with Russia. And they got FDR, who's creating the New Deal, which starts to smell like that to our industrialists. And Hitler, who is not twisted off and started murdering Jews and building death camps yet, is, and this is not to say that America was a big fan of Jewish people either, but Germany has not done any of that yet. Germany's this quote-unquote economic miracle coming out of this absolute massive inflation rubble, and so they start to look like a possible way, and they're fascists. And America has a huge German component. Almost all of us have some German blood in them, and there was a big discussion in America, should we side with Germany and should we fear the Soviet Union? And there are churches and
newspapers and lots of people having that discussion, just like we do now, saying you should hate Cuba or you should love it. I mean, this is the same kind of dialogue that any free system has. And we could have very easily sided with Germany and against the Soviet Union. And England was more afraid of Germany than they were the Soviet Union. And England worked an enormous spy network and financial network in the United States to convince us not to do that. And I found that stuff when I started getting into it. That was just so intriguing of imagining bad politics today is not hard. But when we think back to those times, we think somehow it was purer, and it wasn't. It was just as dysfunctional, just as dishonest, just as bought and sold. We just don't think of it that way. So it's another thing I would say along that same line of not thinking it that way is you and all your listeners have heard, you know, the winners write the history books. And if you think about the Alamo and Texas, if you think about that and say, let's dissect the Alamo, why they were there, who owned the land, what they were doing, who those guys were, and not look at it as a John Wayne movie. And if you were in Texas and you decided to look at that in that fashion and started saying things about Davy Crockett and other people, you'd get shot on the street. I mean, that is not okay. And the first industry review of this book, the Publishers Weekly, gave it a big, huge review and made a big deal out of it, and they called the Haganah, which was a terrorist group supporting the Zionists killing the English, called them thugs in this review. And the alarm bells went off inside groups that I know that were talking to me, say that's never been done before by an industry publication because that's their Davy Crockett. And that inside Israel, the Haganah is certainly not looked as terrorists. They're looked upon as the heroes that defeated the English. And they have statues and streets named after them. But if you look at history from the other guy's point of view, they tell a wildly different story. Now, I'm not saying which one is true or not. I'm just saying you don't romanticize the players because the guys that are out there using bayonets are using bayonets. And there's an end result from that that's never pretty, even if it's your guy doing it.
We're talking to Charlie Newton about his new novel, Traitor's Gate. I guess one of the things I really appreciated about this is nobody comes off as the hero. I mean, yeah, we have our two main characters, but in terms of nations or corporations or whatever, nobody's the good guy. They all do horrible things. And it's hard for us, I think particularly as Americans, to look at the world not in black and white, but as a bunch of people who do some good things and some bad things all the time, and it's basically a giant mess. And, I mean, as I was reading your book, I was thinking, you know, World War II, here you have corrupt governments, corrupt corporations, and it all leads inexorably to World War II, which in turn leads to tens of millions of people dead, Jews and Gentiles, soldiers and civilians. And when you look at the present day and you look at our version of corruption and corporate greed and the double talk and the rhetoric and the rationalizations and the posturing and the grandstanding, our version of this, in my view, which your book made me think about, is the ruin of nature itself. And when all of this sort of climate change denial and pollution and all the crazy things that we're doing as a culture and as a world are done, it is conceivable that in a similar way, the world will lie in ruins and have to be rebuilt. And rebuilding nature is even harder than rebuilding society. That's what your book made me think of.
Well, and I love hearing that, you know, there's the message is fairly deep in this. It's, you know, told around a love story that meant a lot of two damaged people trying to find a way. And they walk through this set of conditions that you're describing, trying to get what they want and then make sense out of it at a much smaller level, which is just her and him and who we are and how damaged we are. And all of this betrayal and all of this damage plays out at the smallest level and the biggest level. And I found that to be tremendously intriguing. And you attributing or
maybe not attributing, but describing what this book's about in terms of the environment, I think is exactly the same thing. It's, are you going to deny the facts? Are you going to deny them in a sufficient way as to say they have no value even worth discussing? And when you see that, you know, you typically use, going back to the, my word, demonization of things, means people don't want to have a discussion. And I think the mythology of the world, at least as I read the history and talk to the people and go to the places, is very much this just polished version of, I don't want to think about that, it's too complex, I want to think about this because I got this problem in front of me today. In other words, I'm going to drive this pickup truck, it gets 20 miles per gallon, and I don't want to think about all the changes I'd have to make if I was talking about improving the environment down the road. And you can elect, in your case, let's say Barack Obama with this huge mandate, and you think he's going to change the grid, and you're going to have solar and wind, and you're really going to start thinking about it like Germany has, of how do we do a better job and create a lesser carbon footprint. And even during that discussion, they never start talking about what it costs in terms of a carbon footprint to eat meat and translate this basic behavior of our culture into, hey, maybe that's a far worse problem than the car you drive. Just, and all I'm speaking to is the logic of some end goal, which you speak to, is let's not have this cataclysmic war with the environment we have to rebuild. Why don't we just not have it?
Right.
But in order to do that, you'd have to look at your day-to-day behavior and say, well, if you stop consuming, let's say gasoline, less consumption means less money. And if there's less transactions, then the people that create jobs and create products for sale and do all these other things, they're afraid they're going to have less profit. And as long as you're in a consumption-based environment, which pre-World War II was as well, you're always, as a group of people, the consumer, the softest voice. I mean, you've gone to the doctor recently, right? I mean, all you are in our system in the United States, you're the cattle, right? I mean, the transactions between an insurance company and the medical corporation, and all you are is cattle. And you sit there and wonder, why am I waiting for an hour? I've got a job. And I'm going, you know, it's, you can take this, what's in this book, you can take it through the entire set of systems that are driven by profit, not functionality.
Right.
And there's, it just doesn't make any sense to me that you wouldn't try to find an economic way, both as a government in terms of inducements and as a culture, to use mass transit and to use solar and to use wind. And it's just you and me, and I, from the way you sound, that's where we'd start. And then we'd work backward. How could we do that? And the way our culture works is we'll find British Petroleum for the Gulf of Mexico and move on.
And this was true in the 1930s, and this is true in the present. And it's somehow easier to see it in the past than in the present. But I guess what I appreciate about your book is it kind of, without being didactic at all, I mean, these are conclusions that I draw, not that you bring out in the book in any kind of direct way, but it does bring all of these things up. And you have, okay, so you've got this character of Eddie Owen, the petroleum engineer, and he actually gets a job in his field, which is a great miracle because then he can continue his quest to keep his family from losing their land and going to California with everybody else who was trudging to California during the Dust Bowl. He's sent to Bahrain to produce this high-octane aviation fuel, and in the course of time, he is courted by a very charming, very ruthless Nazi named Erich Schroeder, who, of course, wants to put him in a position where he can blackmail him into giving up the fuel formula so that Germany can make this fuel. And I thought one of the things that you did so skillfully was recreating the kind of rhetoric and rationalizations that people use to basically do horrible things to each other and make it sound as sweet as pie.
Well, yeah, and that's part, I think, of a writer's job is that whoever you're going to discuss be him. You know, don't decide that, you know, Austin Powers is the good guy and Goldfinger is the bad guy. Be Goldfinger, right? You know, try to come across with what's his story? Why is he doing what he's doing? And, you know, possibly he sees his villainy and doesn't care. Possibly he doesn't see it at all. And I think all of the players, it's the uber morality of state still applies today, whether you're talking to Barack Obama on the left or Dick Cheney on the right. The people that say they are protecting the state, or Netanyahu in Israel, or pick any Palestinian leader, any of these other people are saying what we're doing is justified because either we lack the tools to do something else, or the outcome, if we don't, is so horrific to us, we just have no choice. And that force of arms defends every nation on earth and always has, and there you go. So as the World War II was coming together, it's the same thing as what we're seeing in Iraq now between the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds. And everybody was told that story, and I know that firsthand before we went in the first time, that it was the three-way civil war, that their democracy was a lunacy, and that it would never happen. And you may have seen where Rumsfeld just came, you know, Bush's architect just came out a couple of days ago and said, you know, he always had reservations about democracy. And then you can go back to Vietnam and see the same thing, where after the war, the geniuses wait 15 or 20 years, and if history doesn't come back to them, they go, well, gosh, you know, I kind of always, McNamara did the same thing. I always sort of thought that it was impossible. Yet they do it. And they do it at a time when the conditions say that uber morality of state makes sense, that we'll partner with these guys. In Afghanistan, we partner or attempt to partner with the Northern Alliance, who are the largest opium dealers in the world. They now supply, and at that time, pre-Taliban, supplied 90% of the world's opium. That ends up on the streets of Chicago, funding street gangs of 30,000 people with machine guns, and they shoot citizens and policemen. But the demon at the time was, is Afghanistan going to become a state that sponsors Osama bin Laden and others, and they blow up the World Trade Center in every city in America? So the greater demon was that. Uber morality said you could partner with them. The unintended consequences are things we dance with. And every one of those guys, those big players in World War II, had a legitimate reason from their perspective to do what they did, including the Germans. You know, until the Germans started building death camps, the Germans were doing what the English had done, what the French had done, what everybody had been doing when colonialism was the right thing to do, what, in fact, the Zionists were doing. And when I wrote the book, my agent, who's Jewish, said to me that it's going to be really difficult for modern America to understand the difference between Zionism and being Jewish, because the words are just too close and clear. And I said, Zionism is a colonial behavior. It's not, I know what it is, right? And I said, well, that's important to me, that as a dialogue that we discuss that British Mandate Palestine was a mandate given by the United Nations saying you have this colonial right. Who the hell are they to say that? And the Zionists are David Ben-Gurion and the group. And David Ben-Gurion, by the way, the guy that basically created Israel, I mean, an absolute genius. And if you've ever haven't read his autobiography, I highly recommend it. He's an atheist. And he's on record as saying he had to attach religion to it to gain the financial support of Jews worldwide that had money to help him create Israel. And if you are looking at this and saying, well, I'm going to tell America that Zionism is a colonial behavior no different than what the English were doing or the French were doing, and then we're going to have a dialogue on the basis of, is that acceptable? If you take religion out of it, this is before the death camps were built. Zionism started in the 20s. You should be able to look down on that from your sofa in liberal America, the same way you would look on colonialism coming from the English or the French. And that was the position I wanted the woman and the people from there to take, that if you were an indigenous Semite, then you could be Christian, you could be Jewish, you could be an atheist, you could be a Muslim, And if you had stayed in the region, didn't move to Russia or Europe 20 generations ago, and now want to come back under this colonial flag, if you stayed here, then you were welcome here. It wasn't a war of religions within the Semitic tribe that had stayed in Palestine. It was a war against the colonial invaders, of which Zionism was one. And there were many indigenous Semites, some of them Jewish, who were deeply unhappy that these moneyed and more powerful Jewish people that had moved to Russia were now going to come back and take over the country they'd stayed in. And I really wanted to have that conversation because nobody had it. Nobody had it in a novel, at least. It was hard to find. And I thought that played out well relative to the tribal situations we get in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places where we're trying to apply some modern theory of state to a tribal area. And one last comment on that is I was having this discussion with some people in Washington the other day, and I kept coming back to the lines that define these countries were established by the British. Iraq, Iran, Lebanon, all these places were made up demarcations that split through tribal lands, and that was done because the West didn't have a way to deal with tribal leaders. We've done very poorly with the Indians in America. And so what the English were following that same route and saying, we'll create a country, we'll install a leadership, and then we'll dialogue with that leadership because we know how to do that, which made great sense on paper, but it made no sense on the ground then. It helped fuel World War II, and it makes no sense now. Yet we're still doing it.
And the rhetoric that we used then and that we use now with respect to these people who are being pushed around or colonized or treated in the ways that you describe is really condescending and kind of infantilizing the attitudes of the colonizer toward these people, tribal or otherwise. And I think you do a great job expressing that condescension, which is... so gross. It's so sort of horrible to hear.
You see that in gentrification, real estate gentrification in America now. That has been, and I was part of. I did a bunch of that, going into bad neighborhoods and reclaiming buildings, and then it becomes, well, what's bad? Once you stand back far enough from you, well, what's a bad neighborhood? And how do you define that? Is that income-based? Is, is it crime-based? What is the solution to move those people, whoever lives there, farther away somewhere else, or to make them like you? Or if they are part of your tax base, are you going to enforce rules on them if you have to pay taxes in order to support their behavior? And all those things are reasonable questions. In the uber morality of state, it often comes down to, you have stuff I want. You have water or oil, or you have access, you have coastline, you have these things, and then that's recouched and restated into something that says this person who has that is less, or I was there before he was, or I wrote a book. Like, you pick any one of the big six religions, and they always go back to their book as proof that they're right, except you and me would look at that and say, well, except you wrote the book.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure that's a reasonable position to take, that you wrote the book that now allows you to behave this way and colonize under God's flag. I wanted to say that, too, that the other guy, if he's not trying to harm you, you don't necessarily have the right to demonize him and take his stuff and tell him to live a certain way and pay taxes to a certain person. The behaviors that led to World War II and are leading us wherever we're going now very much are about that. If you deciding your way is the right filter and that the other guy's way is the wrong way, and you're going to go and explain that to him, and whether that's the Spanish Inquisition or any number of those you can mention, it never works out very well unless you kill them all, which is what Hitler was attempting to do. Was absolutely, he wasn't trying to do anything other than erase that population, because if he left any of them alive, he'd have to deal with them later. That kind of real genocide is translated into uber morality of state when you do it economically, when you just say, well, we'll marginalize that group to the point they no longer matter.
Right. Which we see playing out in now in Palestine.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's no way to look at even Jimmy Carter, you know, again, not one of my favorites or not, but it is when he brought up that it is an apartheid state. And I'm from South Africa half the time in my childhood, and I know what an apartheid state is, and Israel's an apartheid state. And for Israel to take the position, they took a similar position to England, of being the little country that could. And at one time, in 1948, that's what they were. And that's not what they're now. They're not that now. They're nothing like that now. And Israel, when people talk about them in the United States, they talk about, interestingly, they talk about the Jewish lobby. It's not the Jewish lobby. It's the Israeli lobby. And if you look at the Israeli lobby and how our politicians kowtow to it, you just change the name to China or France or somebody else, you'd be horrified. The politicians wouldn't line up to be seen in front of this. They wouldn't say, you know, I love Israel before they critique Netanyahu being here lecturing our Congress. Not that anybody, you know, anybody on the planet could lecture our Congress, but a classic there of this non-dialogue is Israel has somewhere between 200 and 500 illegal nuclear weapons. And Israel is over here lecturing us on not allowing Iran to have a nuclear weapon, which may be a great idea. But nobody mentioned that the person lecturing us is running a state that has had an illegal nuclear weapons program since 1960. And I found that disgusting, that the politicians here were unwilling to couch this dialogue in, here's what happens. If you're a neighbor of Israel, even if you're an awful person, awful country, you have every right to be scared to death of Israel's nuclear weapons if Israel has the right to be scared of Iran's, and they don't have one yet. And to pretend that there's not this incredible imbalance in the Middle East based on Israel's power and its willingness to use it defeats any kind of American purpose, since Israel isn't our country. Whatever Americans' purpose is there is defeated if we don't discuss that. And when you go talk to the Palestinians, this is so sad, and I've told them to their face, they still think we're going to save them. And I told them that you guys are in a civil war. There isn't anybody to save. If you ever got out of a civil war and formed a country that was backable, we still wouldn't save you. We don't do that. That's what we do in the movies. That's not what we do in real life. And so this is another way to state, as I do in a book, that this conflict's coming. In one form or fashion, it's coming. If Israel continues with the settlements or doesn't, if Israel gave up its nuclear weapons or doesn't matter. It's still coming. They're surrounded by people that don't like them, whose word won't be any better than theirs is, and yet America's all tied up, mixed up in that. And this takes me back to your environmental position of, if we decided to be self-sufficient and didn't need to care about oil, we wouldn't be funding Israel's military, Germany would be. And Europe and them would then have to understand and figure out what's the economics of this behavior and is there a two-state solution, and all the stuff you and me keep hearing about, keep getting emotionally invested in, and then Netanyahu says to get elected there'll never be a two-state solution. I don't know how you felt, but I was absolutely furious. Not that I think he's any different, you know, running a country that's just as polarized as ours. I don't think he's any different than our politicians, but I was stunned that he was unafraid to say that, knowing that our politicians are so dishonest and so corrupt, they'd find a way to say, well, yeah, of course he had to say that to get elected, and then somehow we're all supposed to think that's okay, and give him more money, which our president has done. He's actually increased how much money he gives him. It's insane.
We're talking to Charlie Newton, and actually we're talking about his novel, Traitor's Gate, which brings up all of these questions about Middle Eastern politics, U.S. politics, profiteering, corporatism. And in the novel, Eddie Owen, our hero, comes into possession of some papers, and the papers were these detailed signed plans for German extermination camps. And at the time, in the book, there was some question about whether these camps would be in Europe or the Middle East. Is that true?
Yeah. Adolf Eichmann, actually, and I'm proud I have to explain who he is, he actually was sent to the Middle East to put the camps, to build the infrastructure there, the obvious thought being that if all these European and Russian citizens, fundamentally European Jewish people, were murdered, and it was they were not murdered on German soil or even European soil, and they were in fact murdered by Arabs, it would demonize the Arabs. And so that way Hitler can get rid of all the Jewish people that he doesn't want in Europe anymore, and he considers Europe his country at this point. But he also gives him an indictment of the Arabs and allows them to move in on them as well after the fact. So it was very much the plan.
In the middle of this book and all of these politics that we're talking about, there is a rather unlikely meeting and love story between the two main characters, the Palestinian nationalist Sabah Hassouna and the petroleum engineer from Oklahoma, Eddie Owen. And I guess we will leave it to our listeners to discover when they read the book, which I have to say is it's so gripping and, you know, rich in historical detail. And I was kind of visualizing it being made into a mini-series. Do you have any ambitions to bring this book to the screen in any way?
I'm represented by ICM, and that is the general thought that I finished the second book to that, much like Wokes, Winds of War and War and Remembrance. I finished it, actually, and sent it to my agent on the day this one published. And so it's perfect for that. Now, whether or not the marketplace, you know, lots of my stuff has been optioned but never made, and, you know, I can't speak to whether it will happen or not. I mean, I think it does fit it really well, and it may happen, it may not. But, you know, when you write these, you write them because you really want to write them. Your hope for any kind of economic impact is, if you still have that, you're an idiot, you know, so I don't have that. This is the 15th, 16th book I've written, and I published three. So you better write them because you care about what you're writing, and you know, if down the road, you know, you can stop eating your lunch out of a can, then you want on that level. But, I mean, I'm thrilled somebody like you has read it carefully and knows it and understands it. And I put a lot of work, that book took 2.5 years and, you know, halfway around the world twice. But it was a pleasure writing it, right? I mean, so the real payoff for me was writing it, and then the icing would be people like you who decide they're interested enough to want to talk about it. And, you know, you see the environment, and that's really fabulous. I really like that. And there are so many parallels. There's so much. It's an easy thing to discuss, the combination of IG Farben and Standard Oil, you know, Irene DuPont and General Motors, and people don't know those things. And when they see them, they're going to go, that's just not possible, and they put it into Bing or Google and go, oh, my God, you know, that's in the congressional record. That actually happened. And it changes how we would look both at our corporations who are not innately evil, but when we're told by, you know, if you're a Bill O'Reilly person or a Chris Matthews person and you turn on that channel and they preach to your choir and you think that stuff's true, it's not. They're selling advertising.
Right.
And they didn't say they weren't. You know, you're the one that decided it was true, and it was simple because it sounded like how you felt, and you do a little homework, you know, and you go, oh, my God, that probably isn't the real reason that happened that way. It's probably something like follow the money. And this book and others like it give you a good background in a way to think about, well, God, that's a fabulous story. I wonder if that part right there really could happen, and you find out it's happened 50 times.
Exactly. Yeah. I have to say, I listened to much of the book on audiobook, and it's a terrific performance, complete with, the guy is amazing. He does all these accents from Texan to German and Middle Eastern and Czechoslovakian, and some of them better than others, but it was just a really terrific kind of spellbinding audiobook. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, when you've been here in the past, we've talked about the publishing industry, and you've chosen to publish this book in a new way. I wondered what you're doing, what's going on in publishing that's guiding your choices?
Lack of options. I guess the big picture would be my book previous to this was published by Doubleday, which at the time was the top of the mountain. I mean, you know, I'd worked a long time, 12 years, and finally got the most powerful editor, Jason Kaufman, at the best imprint, Doubleday, and was able to publish this really gritty crime fiction book that would typically not be published by them. And they did very poorly with it. I mean, they didn't have books in the stores the first week that the book came out in Chicago. I was in the New York Times and L.A. Times and Chicago, all this publicity that people like me don't get. And their system was in some form of transition, and they very, very, very much underperformed. Prior to that, I had been with Simon & Schuster, and something similar happened with them. And so my assessment of New York and big publishing, this is pre-ebook, really, has been pretty low. And then ebooks came out, if you recall, and they came out, and everybody kind of laughed at them. And then you get an ebook, you were less of a writer, blah, blah, blah. And then ebooks sort of took over and became this enormous profit center. And then Amazon shows up, and they're the little guy that could, and then they turn into the great Satan. The bookstores start to go under from a very poor economic model to begin with, and New York goes to war with Amazon. And unfortunately for the writers, the top 1%, the James Pattersons and the like, are doing better than they've ever done, and everybody else is doing worse. There are far more books being published than ever before, but standing out, if you deserve to or not, amongst that tidal wave of books is just very, very hard. So as Amazon continues, who's my publisher now, Thomas & Mercer is their imprint, Amazon continues to become more and more and more important in book world, and therefore more and more and more threatening to any bookstore, and to New York in particular. There is a metric floating around, I don't know if it's true or not, that 80% of all books, no matter how they're published or who publishes them, are eventually sold on Amazon. So there's a backlash that I know you've heard about, that if your book is published by Amazon, many of the people who are affiliated with New York or are affiliated with bookstores or independent bookstores won't carry your book or talk about it. And to date, not one of the reviewers who have reviewed my first two books has reviewed this book. Not one bookstore, including the one in Santa Fe, they're not interested in having me. And I don't think it's because of me and the book, although I'm not the funnest person you're going to meet. And the book, I don't think is terribly flawed, but maybe it is. I think the real issue here is Amazon, that if you side up with that team, and I sided up with him because nobody in New York would publish this book. Doubleday, who was my publisher at the time, would not publish it. And my agent, who was a really big-time agent, shopped it to everybody in all the biggies in New York, and nobody would touch it. And so Amazon quite bravely stepped up and said they'd publish it as is. Now, they don't pay anywhere near the same kind of money. And when you publish with them, you're publishing generally inside their universe for the reasons I just said. So a person is not going to run into my book in a bookstore. I'd make that a 99-to-1 shot that ever happened. And the people who I know well are not reviewing this book. So I asked a couple of questions as it happened just earlier today. And they said, well, the range of reasons why would be, and this is, speaks to the state of publishing, it's 600 pages. So for a reviewer, it's a commitment. And it's published by Amazon, and a number of the blog sites very specifically state they do not review Amazon books, and a number of the bloggers specifically state they won't review it. Third, it's Palestinian, which if you're not connected to this discussion, you don't have to be pro-Zionist or pro-Israeli or pro-anything. You can just say, well, my memory of Palestinians is they blow up school buses, and I don't want to read anything that's positive about them. And those three things are potentially the reason that nobody has reviewed it, nor will they probably review it.
Well, we are here in the Santa Fe Baking Company talking about it, and unfortunately it's actually time to go, but I do want to let people know that this book that we're talking about is called Traitor's Gate by Charlie Newton, and it is available on Amazon as a book as an ebook and also as an audio book. So there are choices, and it's a terrific journey. I think it's also available on like you can get a CD set and put it in your car if you don't want to have that kind of stuff on your phone. So lots of ways to listen to it or read it. And I just think it's a terrific read, and not only gripping and full of all the ideas that we just spent the last hour talking about, but just a lot of fun and really fast-moving, real page-turner. So, Charlie Newton, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great talking to you, Mary Charlotte, and hope I get to see you again soon.
Excellent.